Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
You know, now after years of pull up, like, oh, look, there's mountains there. That's why. And we're trying to pull up, but, you know, the question, I guess, to continue the metaphor is, can the airframe handle it? I don't know.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Welcome to this episode of Finance U. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and today I am genuinely honored to bring you one of the clearest, most courageous voices in macroeconomics today, Luke Grohmann, founder and CEO of Forest for the Trees, or FFTT. You can see it in his background there. And Luke is the analyst who saw the weaponization of the dollar coming years before Russia got kicked out of SWIFT, who's been relentlessly documenting the U.S. debt spiral. We'll get into that today. The rise of de-dollarization, so many things coming to a head, and the return of gold as money. While most of Wall Street was still chanting transitory inflation, our favorite word, transitory, his weekly research notes are legendary. They move billions in institutional money. They make Treasury officials sweat, and they've been dead right on the biggest trends of the last decade. Now, I've been reading Luke's work for a decade or so, and every single year I think, okay, this is the year the mainstream finally catches up. Spoiler, they still haven't. So buckle up, Luke Grohmann is here for the next hour or so. No spin, no sacred cows, just unvarnished truth about where the financial system is actually headed. Luke, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back on. It's great to be here, Chris.
Well, let's start from the outside in. You've been talking about how you think volatility is going to be coming back, which is code speak for sometimes stocks go down, not up, number up to the right. What's the vibe right now? You work with a lot of people who are, we'll say, financially well-connected, if not titans in some cases. So what's the vibe out there right now, you would say, in terms of confidence in where things are headed?
I think there's some cautiousness, just some flashing yellow signs, if not outright flashing red signs. And whether that is, I think sort of first and foremost that has people's attention is what's happening in the bond market, particularly in Japan, where we're seeing yields that, you know, go those are going up and to the right every day, ending in Y lately. And that is something that veterans are very focused on, simply because there is there have been really over the last, gosh, 30 plus years, there have been basically two big carry trade funding currencies. And it was the yen from, call it, 1990 through, you know, probably still ongoing to a certain level, but certainly 1990 to, call it, 2010, and then 2010 since the dollar. And so what that means as a carry trade is that ultimately if those currencies get, people have borrowed in those currencies. And so if those currencies get too strong, it begins to create forced unwinds of carry trade, you know, borrow short, lend long, borrow short, invest long. And so historically speaking, when we see interest rates on the yen on JGBs, 10-year JGBs rise, we usually get some period of volatility, in part because it starts to force yields elsewhere around the world. And we're seeing that maybe a little bit on the margin as it relates to treasury bonds in the last even week to 10 days, not even. And so I think people are focused on that. I think people are focused on the front end of what we've been seeing there in some of the strains in U.S. funding markets, which I still... What we're seeing in terms of those strains and stresses, they're not huge and problematic instantaneously like they were, say, back in 2019 when we saw the spike in repo rates or overnight funding rates in the U.S. But the veterans are all looking at it's as a pressure gauge. And if you look at slowly but steadily rising overnight funding rates here, too, these are very important to funding, broadly speaking, global dollar carry trade. And so the cost of borrowing dollars is creeping higher in overnight markets. It's not problematic yet, But it's one of these things where, you know, little by little and then all at once, and no one really knows where sort of the trigger point is where that's problematic. You layer in geopolitics, you layer in which is uncertain, you lay in the fiscal side, you layer in what's happening with AI, and there's a robust debate around is it a bubble? Is it bursting? I can tell you people in you know, again, market veterans are paying very close attention to the fact that the AI and data center world have begun borrowing money to make these investments, really in size only in the last 3-4 months. Up until that point, they'd largely been funding out of cash flows, retained earnings, which is not as big a deal. But now that they're starting to borrow money, A, it's raising questions around AI, and B, it's competing with the U.S. Treasury and the Japanese for capital globally, which puts further upward pressure on rates. So there's a lot of, I would say, people are paying attention to all of this dynamic in a world that has, you know, people understand how levered the system is, and it's making people nervous. And that's why I say I think ultimately it's a flashing yellow. It's not red light yet, but it's one of these things where they don't give you sort of the sound tone at the beginning of a car race, right, where it's a beep, 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 beep. It's just, you know, beep, beep, beep. You don't know, right? And it's like, oh gosh, yeah. I gotta hit the gas. So, yeah, I think there is a you know, when we look at it tactically, there's a degree of major factors that are making investors, I think, tactically uncomfortable slash cautious.
So let's begin with this then, because this feels almost what you're talking about is a regime change. Okay, so we had 2008 GFC, lessons went unlearned. And I score that because I say too big to fail became bigger, and the derivatives that were the cornerstone of that are doubled in size, right? So I'm going to sort of score that as lesson unlearned. But what the Fed and other central banks seem to carry into that was liquidity fixes all ills. A major source of that liquidity was the Japanese carry trade, which I know about, but Luca, I don't actually know how big it is, and I haven't found anybody who can really put their arms around that number, but we know it's big. So A, if do you know how big it is, but B, weirdly, I'm watching these JGBs, the Japanese government bonds, rise in yield, and I'm not watching the yen strengthen all that much. How do we interpret that?
Yeah, I have no idea how big it is to answer the first part of that question, other than, you know, what we can point to empirically in markets, which is, you know, summer of 2024, when the yen got too strong, it was bad for basically everything except gold. And that's right. Paradoxically, when the yen gets too strong, another way of saying that is if the dollar gets too weak. And so, and the flip side, if the dollar gets too strong, we've seen that multiple times empirically over the last several years, or the yen gets too weak, that's also bad for risk markets. And so you're increasingly trapped between Scylla and Charybdis, if you will, of too strong a yen, too strong a dollar. And as debt levels rise, the gap between Scylla and Charybdis narrows just by virtue of the math and the leverage. In terms of the message of rising Japanese bond yields and the yen still falling, that's troubling. That is emerging market type price action. When your yields are rising and your currency still falling, That's a fiscal crisis. That's a currency crisis precursor, a warning sign. And so normally when you start to see those types of things in emerging markets, once they get to a critical point, what happens is you get some sort of crisis, and then some sort of multilateral like the IMF comes in and says, you guys can't run your own show and you need to, you know, implement austerity. You need to hike rates a lot. You need to cut government spending and starve the economy of capital. There's a severe recession. And that finally stops the currency from going down and stabilizes things at the cost of a very severe real decline in output in the country and a lot of human suffering, for lack of a better word. Greece is a perfect example. For maybe the most recent. The challenge in this case is it's Japan, which is the second or third biggest bond market in the world, a developed economy. It is somebody that if you talk to most investors, or certainly many investors in the U.S., there's a almost dogmatic faith that Japan is going to be the play a major role in reshoring and reindustrializing the U.S. and in investing to do that, and that might be the case, but they can't do that if they're having to be implemented austerity to support their currency. And so when we see the yields rising and the currency falling in a place like Japan, it's troubling, but it's also something we've never really seen in 40 plus years. We've seen it in developing markets over and over and over and over. We saw it in Greece and in sort of the pigs trade, I guess, if you will. It's kind of a derogatory name I never particularly cared for, but that's what it was known as, right? Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, Spain, back in the, call it 2010s, 2011, Euro crisis. So we have seen it within a developed market, the EU, but it was kind of the more EM-like and certainly EM finance-like pigs that were suffering these issues, and primarily this is Japan. Like, this is a different animal altogether. So, you know, it's one of these things where we don't know exactly how it's going to play out yet, but we know it's not sustainable. We know it's not good. And sort of, you know, no matter which path you choose, you know, are they going to choose the bond market? Are they going to choose a currency? It really comes down to that question.
Well, that sounds vaguely Austrian, to, you know, misquote Ludwig von Mises badly, but he said, you know, at the end of a credit expansion, your options are voluntary abandonment of that, which is austerity, that hurts, or the complete collapse of the currency system involved. Is that what we're talking about here?
That's where this is pushing to. That's when you see yields rising and you don't see currencies falling as well. That's, you know, that is the sort of the jumping off point, right? You know, the old Yogi Berra, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. You know, that's the fork. That's the fork in the road that we're heading towards, which, you know, we're not there yet. But that's what the price action is saying, is, hey, we are going down this path. And, you know, I don't know you know, what old adage, where it's from, but it's, you know, if you start on a path going somewhere, don't be surprised when you arrive at your destination. And so yeah. I don't know how many steps between here and our destination, but I can tell you that price action is heading us toward that fork in the road.
Well, sort of the sense that there's rising pressures on the system, and sometimes they can resolve peacefully, but sometimes they create a situation where the cornice just gives way, and then you have to deal with that. I'm wondering if we could put this in context, because there's another pair trade that is, I think, giving us a signal. I'd love to get your view on it. Gold just rising, small attempts to Mr. Slammy to take it down, not very effective. Obviously, a lot of buying pressure. But my ultimate liquidity gauge for the past 4 years has been Bitcoin. It is no longer behaving as it has in the past. And is it wrong to maybe connect that to what we're talking about with Japan, that somehow it just tells me that liquidity is not as abundant in the system as it once was, with maybe Japan being a source?
No, I agree. I agree. And I apologize for interrupting you. I agree. It's for me, you know, something I started calling it probably 2019, 2020, maybe even earlier, was I saw Bitcoin as the last functioning smoke alarm of liquidity within the system, which is, because especially back then, a little less so now, there's more derivatives attached to Bitcoin than there were then, but it's still a relatively pure market. The derivative markets aren't that big attached to it, and there's still an element of the technology itself where it's pretty hard to create unallocated Bitcoin derivatives, certainly in the size that that has been done in gold and silver historically over the last 40, 50 years. And so When Bitcoin falls sharply, for me, it is absolutely, you know, a warning sign. And so when I was watching what we kind of talked about in terms of, you know, these rising yields in Japan, rising 10-year yields in the U.S. a little bit, you know, more importantly, the short-term funding strains in the U.S., concerns about an AI bubble, competition for capital between the Japanese and the Americans and the AI, et cetera. When you then see Bitcoin break down the way it broke down, it is absolutely, to me, a potential warning signal, particularly then when, you know, I don't spend a lot of time in the technicals. In terms of technical analysis, because I'm not very good at it, and the guys that do that are really good at it, and so it's important for me. You know, I don't go out and try to play linebacker for a professional football team, and I don't try to do technicals, right? I'm going to get hurt. But I do watch some certain long-term momentum indicators, and I put because that's what we try to do. We're trying to look for these big shifts at FFTT, and in light of all of what we just described, Bitcoin on various long-term momentum indicators broke down forcefully, multiple different indicators, you know, in the last, call it, month or two. And these momentum indicators, by virtue of being monthly reads, they've only broken down three prior times. It was, you know, the end of the Bitcoin cycle in 14, the end of the Bitcoin cycle in 18, the end of the Bitcoin cycle in early 22, and now. And every other time these various momentum indicators have tripped on the downside, A, it's been a sign of the Bitcoin cycle is over, but B, kind of a bumpy stretch of illiquidity coming. And I don't know what the magic is of the 4-year cycle. I think some of it has to do with how, you know, the Bitcoin mining and the difficulty adjustments, etc. But boy, it's happened 3 prior times in 12 prior years, and it has never had a false trigger at the monthly levels. And, you know, the median decline after the signal's been tricked is 60-70% on the downside for Bitcoin. And so, okay, I take that and I overlay that message of, okay, what's happening here? Is this Bitcoin specific or is this liquidity? My working assumption is that it's probably liquidity related, and it's giving us a warning sign the first half of next year is going to be pretty bumpy unless the authorities, policymakers get really aggressive with liquidity. And, you know, is there a possibility that it's a Bitcoin specific thing around AI or around quantum computing? Sure, it's possible, but it's not my base case. Just given everything else, it's something I'm keeping an eye on. Hey, maybe everything's fine, and all these, you know, all it's just related to quantum or it's just related to AI, but I don't know. So for me, the Bitcoin is another thing where I take and I layer on what's happening in Bitcoin to what we were describing before. And it leads me feeling more cautious still in terms of the first half of next year.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I could lift one eyebrow like John Belushi, I would right now. Because that happened for me also when I noticed there were some OG wallets from Satoshi era that dumped or dishoarded a pretty significant stakes in Bitcoin. And to your point, those wallets sat there through successive, and they have stronger trading balls than I do, successive 90% decline, 70%, like some super volatility. And, you know, I don't know how they held on, but they did. And so to me, that was just kind of like, is that insider selling? Is that somebody who's been there from the beginning recognizing something that maybe I don't, because I'm out here in the cheap seats? Thoughts?
You know, it's to me, that strikes me as possible. And it's one of these things where, you know, a man's got to know his limitations, right? Like, I don't have the education to know the math around the quantum and sort of the blah. There's people that I respect greatly in the Bitcoin community. They have pointed to different people in various mathematical communities. And, you know, anytime you want to feel stupid, like pick up something that a quantum mathematician is writing and like explaining, and it's the easiest way to feel like the dumbest person alive, because you just, but the point is that while I have no, I don't have the pedigree, I don't have the experience in those things, I do have 30 years in markets. I have 30 years in finance. And when I see things like those technical indicators breaking down on a long-term basis, number one, and then overlay it with, you know, something else I've been doing for nearly 30 years, which is fundamental bottoms-up research, and just seeing different, you know, the old Jeff Bezos, when the data and the anecdotes disagree, I've found the anecdotes are usually right. There's usually something wrong with the way you're measuring it. 20 to 30 years of my career was in bottoms up fundamental research, where we were just out doing real intelligence work. We were talking to suppliers of various industry verticals, and it was amazing. I was in 100% cash by October of 07. Personally, I was like, anyone I could tell certainly for clients, we had a position like, this is going to get so bad. And that was simply by bottoming up the anecdotes. And so this strikes me as one of these, and I'm not saying that's what's oncoming for Bitcoin. What I'm saying is that I have a lot of experience dealing with anecdotes like this and marrying them with what you're seeing in price action, which is simply information being conveyed. And it's entirely possible, you know, and that's why I say it's entirely possible it is a Bitcoin thing. I don't know. I saw the same thing as you, and I did the exact same, you know, eyebrow of that, because I owned a little Bitcoin 13 or 14. Nobody owned enough. I certainly didn't. I owned it through the 18, 19. I owned it through the 22. And yeah, it is painful. You know, and in 21, I did sell quite a bit of it, and I started buying it back too early. So I've seen three of these cycles. And these people, presumably with large amounts of wealth tied up in it, are very tied in with it. And doing this, you know, it's possible there is informational value there vis-a-vis expectations around the timing of things like quantum computing, which, you know, would in theory have a chance. I just don't know. But if, for me personally, it was the champagne problem of my position. It got, I've owned it, you know, I bought a lot under 30,000, starting in, I guess that was late 22 and early 23. And I let it ride and I didn't trim it at all. And it gets to a point where you have this uptown problem. Okay, now I'm looking at what markets are telling me. I'm looking at these inconsistencies of what you described, these, you know, OG whales selling large amounts in a way they hadn't before. And then the liquidity side of the fundamentals of the broader macro, I just go, you know, a man's got to know his limitations. It doesn't make sense to be as overweight as I am. And so, yeah, I think from a macro perspective, you know, it is possible it is a Bitcoin specific issue, but I just don't know. And look, the Bitcoin community is very dynamic. There's a lot of extremely smart people, and there's a way that they can get around this thing. And so, you know, in terms of the quantum computing risk. So that's why I say my base case is that what we're watching in Bitcoin is more about a liquidity warning than it is a Bitcoin specific warning.
Yeah. And to your point, I love anecdotes, especially at turning points. That's how I went really short things in 2007-08 was just those anecdotes, just like in The Big Short. Like, you know, you walk in and the stripper's telling you about, in, you know, Mark Baum's case, that she's on her 19th home. And you're like, short everything, right? Like, but you know, that, like, the data was not telling me the same story that I was getting from other sources. So, okay, so here we are. And I feel stupid around Bitcoin a lot, also for not getting into it early on, even though I had plenty of opportunities. But just because, for me, I need to understand something fully. I can speculate. I'll invest in something I understand. I'll speculate in things I don't understand. That's sort of my thing. I can't tell you the number of times I've had people tell me, Chris, you just haven't read enough, studied enough, watched it, enough hours of Bitcoin stuff. But even when I do, I still can't totally get around the number one issue for me for money is trust. The more trust you have, the more it operates like money. So a gold coin in my hand I have a lot of trust because I can assess that that's real. But you mentioned, like, the big wild card, which is what is going on with quantum computing and what kind of a risk is the 256 SHA, you know, algorithm under? We don't know. We just don't know. But I do know that things are developing more rapidly technically than I can possibly get my head around, including in AI. So there has to be a little caution just because we don't know what we don't know.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. And with someone with your educational pedigree, right? Like, you are not a dumb man. So,
but I can't get it. I was like, yeah. Whoa, way
yeah,
over my head.
For me, it's all, you know, for me personally, and for my clients, as a, you know, I take great pride in, you know, advising what I, taking a fiduciary responsibility around what is prudent. And for me, you know, I have to understand that that's just a positioning issue for me, right? It's around, you know, how, you know, there are risks there. That's fine. There's always risks everywhere. Then it just becomes, you know, a sizing issue. Ultimately, what's the right position size as a percentage of your liquid net worth in order to mitigate that risk, to get yourself comfortable with that, whatever that risk is. And, you know, the beautiful thing about markets is that number can vary. It does should vary for basically every person on the planet, depending on their wealth, on their disposable income, on their age, on their, you know, health, on their, you know, all these types of factors. And so ultimately, I'm like you at this point on it. I don't know what I don't know. My base case is that it is more liquidity driven than not. And importantly, these momentum indicators that I watched, they didn't trip in February, March of earlier this year. We had a pretty big sell off, right? We went from whatever 104 or something, 104,000 down to, if I remember right, maybe 78,000 or so on Bitcoin. And these momentum indicators, you know, they didn't, you know, they are very, very powerful long-term indicators. They didn't trip off in that case. They never said, hey, there's a problem here. They started to sort of move in that direction, but ultimately that was, you know, they were not tripped until, like I said, about a month, about four or five weeks ago.
Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. So let me connect a couple dots then from our conversation here. So my working definition of a bubble is when asset prices rise beyond what incomes can sustain. So we all know that AI has an income problem at this point in time, and people are starting to get that math. But I just read a statistic that said that NVIDIA's market cap is now more than all of Japan's stock market. That may or may not be true. I didn't verify that for myself, but it's sort of directionally correct, right? And then I wake up one day and I read that Google's developed tensor processing units, TPUs, which directly compete for a big portion of the AI chain with what NVIDIA is coming up with. And the market hasn't reacted at all yet. And everybody's aware that there's a CapEx, you know, they're going to spend 1. Whatever trillion on CapEx. And they're just it's just a money furnace in for 5-6 years. But these things have these data center core units have a depreciation cycle that might be measured in 18 months, 36 months, something like that. Not my first rodeo, Luke. This doesn't square, does it?
So from the AI side, no. No. And that's why, you know, before when I mentioned that, I think the old hands, the graybeards, if you will, are once they start. Right, I'd be if I grew it out, I'd be nearly that gray, but not quite. I'm still salt and pepper there. But us graybeards, this isn't our first rodeo. And when you, for me, one of the things I was watching for specifically was, you know, if you want to throw money in a furnace and you're just taking it out of cash flow and then throwing it in a furnace, that's your business. At the end of the day, that's a franchise issue. That's, you know, it's a management issue. It's not a macro issue as much.
Interesting.
Once you start borrowing money to throw in the furnace is when my attention really got piqued for that. And that really has only started in the last, like literally September, you can start finding the articles in a big way. And it reminded me of two prior times in my career. The first being the telecom boom bubble in, call it early 2000s, that busted in early 2002, late 2001, depending on when you want to kind of talk about it. And same kind of dynamic. They were borrowing gobs and gobs of money to lay as much fiber as they could in the ground because there was going to be all this traffic and the internet was taking off and the old economy was dead and the new economy was going to be all online. And there were, they were in a large part right. Like, that's the important thing, right? They, a lot of what they were saying about the internet and the dominance of this new economy and then the use of all this fiber was 100% true, ultimately, or very, you know, way more true than not. The challenge with debt in any investment is that it shrinks the time you have to be right. Like, they needed, you need to be right much faster if you're borrowing money. And if any little thing goes wrong, if some butterfly flaps its wings and creates a hurricane somewhere, you've got a problem. And, you know, some have said, I have no way of verifying the actual math of this, but some have pointed to Metallica winning their Napster song swapping case in, I think it was April of 01, as being the butterfly that flapped its wings, because so much of the traffic in the fiber was song swapping. And as soon as that happened, you went from having, you know, hey, we've got, we keep laying fiber, we've got, you know, we've got this demand. And all of a sudden, like, hey, where'd all the demand go? Why? And so they were still borrowing money to lay more fiber, and ultimately, you know, boom. The second time I saw it in my career was in the shale boom, the early days, where you especially had a lot of independents borrowing a lot of money. Even if they may have been below break-even costs, once you have debt, you have to keep drilling because your decline rates are so fast. And because cash is cash, right? You might be losing money on every barrel, but you have cash flow coming in on every barrel that you can use to service your debt from before. And it gets to what you and your audience know well, the Red Queen problem or the treadmill problem. And same type of thing. Now, what's really interesting to me is how much this is starting to, the AI borrow money to build these data centers, is starting to look like these two things. You know, burn a lot of cash, build the data centers because the opportunity is so great. The area that is troublingly different, or the way that it's troublingly different, also catches my attention, which is what you just alluded to, which is even after the various bankruptcies in telecom and amongst independent shale producers, the fiber in the ground was still worth a lot of money and for a long time. Mm-hmm. And the oil in the ground, setting aside the initial, you know, rise and decline, there's a long tail on the shale production that goes on for years and years at sort of very manageable, predictable decline rates, slow decline rates. There's value in the ground. Here, I don't know that we have, I am unfamiliar with any situation in my career, certainly, where the useful life is so short because the technology is moving so fast. And I would layer on one more that the tech guys are very unfamiliar with, but I think we're seeing hints of them being familiar with it based on some of their actions, which is, you know, but that we here in Rust Belt USA are very familiar with, which is the Chinese are really good competitors and they don't necessarily need to make a lot of money when they compete, and they will compete and they will be not good competitors early. And then they learn really fast and then they get better than you and 80% cheaper than you. And then you're screwed. And so when we see things earlier this year, like DeepSeek, when you see, you know, I have people in that world that have pointed out to me, the AI data center world, that have said, hey, take a look at this. It's basically a scoreboard of, like, here's the current, you know, according to at least one or two different measuring of AI effectiveness for sort of broad topics, right? They measure it by math. They can measure by different what you're trying to use it for. But just broad effectiveness. And five of the top 10 are Chinese today. And, you know, we know what they have in terms of engineering. We know what they've done. So that, when I look at AI and I say, okay, this reminds me of oil and telecoms, except the useful life, you know, the recoverable asset might be way lower whenever the debt starts to have a problem. And then I look at the tech guys who are not used to competing against the Chinese. They aren't. They just aren't. They've never seen it. We have been so dominant in tech for so long that we can have a debate about, and I'm not the right guy to have that debate, but we can hold a debate around, well, the leading edge, the bleeding edge, America is still ahead of China. That could very well be true. I don't know. Again, I don't have the education to know. But I would push anyone who says that, if they said it to me, say, okay, well, great. Let's assume that's true. Where is that lead? Where's that lead today versus 2 years ago, 4 years ago, 6 years ago? I think they would all say, oh my God, that lead is shrinking rapidly. And so you've got a situation where the recoverable, you know, the useful life is way shorter. The recoverable asset underneath it is probably would have to, at the very least, get marked down way more in recovery. Whenever something on the debt side goes boom, and you get the Chinese competing. Like, the Chinese weren't here competing in shale. They weren't here competing in fiber. I've seen them compete in industrials. I wouldn't want to compete against them. So I look at what's happening in AI, and I just think when you look at the valuations, too hard. Like, it, to me, it just is, ugh. You know, it's tricky.
Well, now we're combining some of my very favorite topics, and so I'd love to get your point of view on this. And by the way, I loved all of that. And it's almost every week I read about something in China, editorially, very little cul-de-sac. But just yesterday I read that they're producing hypersonic missiles for $100,000 that use cement as part. I just crazy, like, off the reservation. We're still hand-building. We don't even make hypersonic missiles, but if we did, it'd be in Huntsville with guys with white gloves turning them out one at a copy for $4 million apiece, right? So very difficult to compete against somebody who has an integrated supply chain. And as I understand it, China's using AI principally to help tune up to be even better at what they do, which is out-manufacture everybody. And so I think that, you know, this whole, I think there's still people like Scott Bessent, just to pick on him a little, who says he has an antiquated view of China. Oh, they make inferior copies and they just copy us. I think if I could sort of paraphrase how he's talked about them. I don't see them that way anymore. Luke, I see evidence every day that their cars, if we could buy BYD cars here, they would crush the competition because they're that good, right? Compared on a cost basis. On and on and on. I see them as actual, legit, serious competitors across every dimension. Military, tech, you name it. And maybe I'm just misreading it and I'm falling for some propaganda, but I don't know. What do you see?
I agree. And I see it multiple different ways, multiple different people, you know, all that don't know each other, all without an axe to grind to me, people that are there, people that are, you know, that work with them. You know, my own experience, it is, you know, I've seen them compete over the last, you know, again, I've been in bottoms up research, you know, for the 15, 20 years before I started FFTT, was in bottoms up fundamental research. And so China was a huge story from, you know, 95 to 2015, part of my career. Huge, huge story. And they just kept getting better. And now you hear from people in manufacturing their ability to just, you know, how quickly they turn around samples, how good it is, how we simply, you know, even, you know, Josh Wolf testified to Congress 2 years ago, investor. And, you know, we wrote about it at the time in our work where Wolf pointed out to Congress in testimony that the Chinese can build a 1 gig nuclear power plant for 1/6 the cost of the U.S. That was then. That was before they've improved it with AI manufacturing. You know, my point at the time was, okay, well, a gig's a gig, right? There's no magic gig in China versus the U.S. It's the same unit. And if it's the same unit, what that tells us is that the dollar is overvalued versus the yuan by 83%, right? 1/6 the cost, 5/6 is 83%. The dollar would have to fall 83% against the yuan to be able to make a gig of electricity in a nuclear power plant in the U.S. cost competitively. Well, 83% devaluation of the dollar, inflation will go nuts here, bond market will go nuts. It's simply, we simply can't compete. And what's interesting is BYD. Apples to apples, 83% cheaper. Industrial components, Apple, I hear from people in Europe and in the U.S., apples to apples, 83% cheaper, 80%, 60%, whatever the number is. And that number is going down because of AI. And then you say, okay, well, once you get to a certain point in terms of improving the efficiency even more with how they're implementing and integrating AI, there's no amount that you can devalue the dollar against the yuan against to compete. You just can't. And that's, I don't know that we're there yet, but I think we're a lot closer to there than consensus thinks. And I don't even, it's another one of these things where I look and go, I don't know how this plays out, but I know it's not good. And I know, you know, it makes me want to own gold, right? Because I know they're settling on a net basis in gold, right? So it's, it goes to, okay, well, if this is how this game is going, then, like, you know, you buy what they're settling in because they value it.
Yeah. So for anybody who wants to, you know, battle test this yourself at home, go to the Chinese site called Temu, temu.com. Pick something you know about. So, Luke, I was just putting up a building, and I needed 8x8 post bases, right? And so you go to Simpson, which is a U.S. manufacturer. They make a galvanized steel thing. It rusts out eventually, but, you know, $94 each just for the post base. No hardware, no install, you know, that's it.
Like the Simpson Strong Tie thing?
What's that?
For the Simpson Strong Tie thing? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, it's a post base that sits down in the concrete,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's got these two little flanges. Anyway, so I go to Temu.com and I buy 8x8 stainless steel post bases with all the fittings, all stainless steel as well, for $23 each. And I couldn't even have bought by stainless steel fittings, I mean, they had expansion bolts, through bolts, screws, whatever you needed, didn't matter, whatever. So I looked at that and like, okay, it's not even close. It's not even remotely close at this point. And I did the same thing for lithium batteries, DeWalt knockoffs, you name it. I've been buying them and testing them, and they work great. I don't even know how they get them here at the price they're selling them for, let alone manufacture them. I don't understand this. Something's very off in this story, which you can detect at the retail level.
Yeah, no, and that's, you know, $23 divided by $94. What's that get us? Rounds to 80% or close to it, right? 60 to 80%. And that's, I hear this story over and over and over. And from wholesale suppliers, what I hear is, oh, by the way, when I want a model, I call the American and it takes, you know, 3 weeks, and somehow I'll call the Chinese and, like, literally they'll have it here the next day somehow. Like, it's, it may be a day after, but you just, like, what? Like, how? And so some of it is a currency. Some of it's a currency issue, clearly. And a lot of it's not a currency issue anymore. And that's the part where, you know, to your point about, I think, you know, Bethan has in some ways a very outdated view of China. I still think he does. I agree with that statement. And that's part of it is they're competing. They're competing. They're competing very effectively. Yes, the currency. Yes, they get subsidies. Of course they get subsidies. And that's another part that sort of cracks me up, which is, oh, well, the Chinese subsidize their industry. So do we. It's just they're subsidizing productive output, and we're subsidizing too big to fail banks. We're subsidizing student loans. We're subsidizing $8 trillion in wars. We're literally, you want to talk about throwing money in a furnace, how we spent $8 trillion in the Middle East from 2003 through that. And so they're just spending their money smarter, right? It's like, well, I don't know, a guy with a Coke habit runs out of money versus a guy who's investing in some business and comparing the two. And we subsidize all kinds of stuff. We just subsidize, in my opinion, the wrong stuff if we want to compete. And I think that's what we're seeing bear out now, 10 years later, 15 years later, 20 years down the road, where the Chinese have the patience to do this. Yeah, of course they subsidize their industry. They subsidize it a lot. And so do we, you know?
Yep. Healthcare stocks, heavily subsidized.
Yep.
All of that. All right, so, but I want to connect back after that. Thanks for engaging in the cul-de-sac. I'm a fundamental analyst and investor, right? So it would, you know, I've been in silver for a long time for strictly fundamental reasons, just supply and demand. And I know the shenanigans that go on. I want to ask you about that in a second. But first, could the butterfly flapping the wings here be AI's demand for power that doesn't actually exist? And another fundamental area that I'm deeply involved in, both as a LP investor at the well level, but more generally as an analyst, is natural gas. I feel like nobody's looking at this like how am I looking at this? And the DOE isn't, but we have so much stuff coming out of the ground. We're past peak on multiple shale fields. We've got two that can still have some runway, but not a lot. And we're just putting all these new LNG terminals in, which are big investments with big multi-year downstream commitments, right? And we've got data centers going in where the numbers are staggering. There was just one Meta center down in Alabama, I think, or Mississippi, 2.2 gigawatt combined cycle plant. That plant alone for that one Meta center, data center, is going to consume 0.5% of U.S. natural gas output if it runs 24/7. So just that one, right? That's just the numbers. So I'm like, that, and that's just one. We know these data centers are being slammed in willy-nilly all over the place. I feel like, has somebody forgotten to look at the actual supply demand of natural gas here? Or is there something I'm missing? Or is this just another case where the U.S. consumer is going to eat it in massively higher electricity costs, and we're going to pretend like that's normal?
Yes. Yes, next question. No.
Yes.
I have a very good friend of mine who calls what we're watching in the energy and data center buildup. He calls it idea machine, and it's a derogatory term meant to, you know, you get the consultants in there and they go, well, we're going to build all these data centers and we're going to build all these pipelines and we're going to build, you know, these LNG terminals, and there's nobody doing what you just did, which is it's 0.5% of the supply as we stand here today. And it's almost, you know, the old economist joke, right? Assume a can opener, right? The old economist joke, three scientists on a desert island, right? A physicist, chemist, and they're trying to figure out, they're stranded, no food, trying to figure out how to get food. And the chemist offers his, the physicist offers his, and the economist says, oh, assume a can opener, right? And so, you know, for the can of food this washes ashore. So, you know, idea machine is like, okay, great. We do have more supplies available in places out west, like Utah, et cetera, some federal lands we've never tapped. Great. And they're like, well, all we have to do is tap that, and we'll get that gas, and then when we get that gas, we'll pipe that in. And they're like, whoa, idea machine. You're gonna have to get rails in there. Who's laying those? You know, by the way, before you get rails in there, you gotta lay, you know, you gotta get the electricity in there. You know, these mining machines don't just run on sunlight. Okay, so you got to run the cable. Who's doing that? No, by the way, what's generating at the end of that? You know, where's the generator? And by the way, generators, on-site generators, are now 5 years out, according to GE Vernova last quarter. So, like, well, we're going to do this all in 5 years. Like, you can't even get a generator for five years. So how are you going to do it in 5 years? Like, well, and that's my buddy goes, idea machine. It sounds really good. And then it's something we've done as a country for the last, I don't know, much of my adult lifetime, but certainly since the great financial crisis, which is manage to optics rather than to outcomes. And if you're doing any sort of engineering, you've got to manage to outcomes and, you know, logistics, right? So when you, to answer your question, I'm not sure they have sat down and looked at the order of operations. I mean, I think the mining guys probably have, and the electricity guys have, but you know, I heard a couple of weeks ago that a major data center land deal was canceled in a very high important data, sorry, in a part of the world, in 2030 or 2031. Because they know with certainty today there's no point in signing a land deal because they know they're not going to get an electricity hookup before that. And so it's one of these things where, you know, you've heard the industry people starting to talk about it with Satya that Microsoft has said, you know, the issue isn't compute, the issue is grid. I've not seen people talk about it on the gas side. Like, I think everything I've seen on the gas side is, you know, own gas because the price is going to go up. That makes sense to me. I've seen interesting cases that, hey, in the same way that gas was a co-product cost, you know, basically when we were drilling shale or fracking shale, gas was coming out and it took gas to near free because it was a co-product. We had nothing to do with it. We're flaring it wherever we could use it. We use it, what have you. I've seen interesting cases that oil could become more of a co-product cost as we go into more gassy areas of various shale basins and oil becomes you know, let's see. So maybe there's some relief for the consumers from lower oil prices, maybe. But then you know, LNG terminal, like you said, very expensive, very long cycle. And obviously the world price of natural gas is well above the domestic price. So that's more upward price pressure on it. And so then I don't think people have done some of the logistics of it and the investing world. You know, I think there's a very small community of people in the sort of the physical production side of it that are kind of going, hey, guys, financial is just like, hey, great. We're going to rebuild a whole grid. And it took the Chinese 30 years, but we're America. So we'll do it in three. good luck with that. But yeah, the cost side is another side of sort of idea machine that people aren't talking about. Let's say gas goes to $6, $7, $8, $9. Now you're gonna have electricity bills, heating bills going up a lot, consumer inflation. And now I know exactly what's gonna happen is they're gonna just X it out, right? Well, it's X energy, it's transitory. And so we're not gonna include that in CPI. Well, that ain't gonna help your political stability, number one. But number two, I don't care. I have to pay this. And so to me, it suggests, why do I want to be in long-term bonds? Like, you know, you can tell me whatever CPI is, but if it's not including energy costs that are going up a lot secularly for the reasons we just described, my purchasing power is going down of my bonds. And we know the government can't afford much higher interest rates. And so it creates a problem over there too. Do we yield curve control it? Where, you know, at what point do the higher energy costs, inflation drive rates to a point that we can't afford? What do we do? This is what happens when you fly a plane by looking at the ground as it goes whizzing by you for the past 30 years, like we have. Sooner or later, if you're heading west, you're going to run into the Rocky Mountains. And if you're looking down, you know, you're going to get a really nasty surprise. And I think we're sort of like, you know, now after years of pull up, like we're like, oh, look, there's mountains there. That's why. And we're trying to pull up. But, you know, the question, I guess, to continue the metaphor is, can the airframe handle it? I don't know.
What was that? An idea machine? Well, I'm thinking of these as almost like unforced errors. So I live in a blue state, and I live blue state adjacent out here in the New England area. You know, New York and also Massachusetts have made it illegal, or they've regulated out of existence, putting in any new gas appliances. It all has to be electric, right? So they're trying to force everybody into electric, but they haven't done the most obvious thing, which is, where's that electricity coming from? Because we're also decommissioning our electrical infrastructure here, nuclear plants, coal, whatever. It's just going to come from somewhere. You know,
the market will determine it. The market will fix this for us. Yeah, it will. Mm-hmm. You know, in the same way as, you know, 2x4 over your head will fix your consciousness. You know,
well said. Well, it's like, you know, if gasoline goes to $10 a gallon, people can voluntarily trim that back. Supply demand price are supposed to come together. So if natural gas prices go higher, people will trim their demand. No, they won't. Electricity is a much stickier, harder. It's harder not to have your house use electricity than it is to not drive your car. It's not a comparable outcome. So I've seen people, Luke, posting electricity bills that kind of look like my first mortgage payments, you know, $1,100 a month, right?
And that's, you know, that becomes, yeah, I think that's, it's an issue. It's the political issue. And it comes back to, you have to have an order of operations of engineers. And when you have a country that is run by lawyers, as ours is, regardless of whether they're red or blue, they're lawyers, versus a country who's largely run by engineers in the case of a lot of Southeast Asia and certainly China. And then you look at a chart, there's a great chart, and you can find it online. I saw it replicated in Leopold Aschenbrenner's situational awareness report last year as it relates to artificial intelligence. And it shows U.S. electrical grid capacity and Chinese. And the U.S. since 2000 is basically flat. We have basically not grown our electricity capacity. And the Chinese went ahead of us in 2008. And in the last 10 years, they've added an entire U.S. grid in just the last decade. And so there's this, and I think it really is a function of when you're run by lawyers, they're really good at lawyering, but they're not very good at sort of first principles dynamics of, you know, it's assume a can opener, assume, you know, electricity comes from the wall and, you know, food comes from the grocery and water comes from the faucet. And excuse me, again, you can do that for a while. You can do it for a long while, but sooner or later, you know, in the case of the debt fueled binge in telecom earlier, Metallica won against Napster, and suddenly no one was allowed to swap songs. And that was a temporary issue. Here, it's AI. Like in this Aschenbrenner chart, it shows that the amount of electricity being consumed or forecast to be consumed globally. So it's a bit of an apples and oranges comparison, but I think still relevant. It's forecast to be 100% of U.S. grid by like 2028, 2029. It was 2030, I think it was. And you go, 2030? Like, that's tomorrow, basically. Markets are going to start looking at that within a, you know, I think they're starting to a little bit now in terms of the, like, where's the grid going to come from? We don't have the grid. But, wow, it's a forcing factor in, you know, idea machine, in reality, in, like, you know, the universe doesn't care whether you stay warm or not, right? It's you have to take care of that.
What did Ayn Rand say? You can ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of ignoring reality.
Perfect quote. That's exactly what's happening here.
Yeah, very well said. I agree with all that. So I have to ask, though, Thanksgiving happens. We come through the weekend. Sunday night, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the CME, has a data center outage that lasts 10 hours. And I know a lot of people who actually program these things, build them, run them, to get my head around this, because I run a website-based business. If it's down for 5 minutes, I'm yelling like a, you know, it just doesn't happen. What's your take on what happened?
It's very curious. I'm like, I didn't get into the depth you did of, but I was sending it around to just different people in the markets world, and then trying to find different people in that engineering slash, you know, guys that build redundancy in that world, you know, for a living. And they were all kind of saying the same thing, which is, doesn't make sense. You know, and there's been a conspiracy theory around what was going on in silver markets. It's entirely possible there's something to that. And the reason I say that is we can see in the weeks up, though, you can go to my X feed, a gentleman named Bob Coleman was highlighting the level of fails to deliver in the SLV silver, and they were rising. The cost of borrow was rising. Look, we know that when push comes to shove, the rules get changed. And so who knows? I have no ability to say, well, yes, for sure, it was because of silver. It was because I try to stay, when I highlight for clients, what can I defend, right? What statements can I try not to make statements I can't defend? Maybe they'll be proven wrong later. But as I sit here today, the statements I can defend are, it's very curious. It's very curious it took that long to come back up. We know there is increasing tightness in silver markets from multiple different financial sources, et cetera, et cetera. And to me, I just look at it not as a thing itself, but as part of a mosaic of a building stress strain in the underlying, you know, physical world of, and it kind of ties back to the energy side, but it ties into the geopolitical side, ties into the trade war, which is, you're seeing the global South, the global East, ex-Japan, basically saying, fine, give us gold, give us silver, we'll give us physical. And even the U.S. is doing that too, right? I mean, we're running around buying up critical minerals. You know, we're selling treasuries, buying critical minerals. And I got people telling me what a great deal long-term treasury bonds are here. Like, maybe, but, you know, they're telling you what they're doing. Like, they're selling bonds that buy critical minerals. I don't know. I want to go alongside them.
Hey, folks, Chris Martinson here. Look, we've all been there, watching our hard-earned dollars get chewed up by this endless inflation machine, while the folks in Washington and the big banks continue to play games with our money like it's Monopoly cash or something. It's not right. I know it, and you know it. The trust in the system? It's eroding faster than a sandcastle at high tide, especially with all the geopolitical storms brewing. Now, I've been saying it for years. You've got to protect yourself, your family, from all this nonsense. That's why I personally turn to gold and silver, the real deal, physical stuff that you can hold in your hands under your control, not some digital promise that could vanish overnight. Everyone should own some. It's just common sense in times like these. But here's the thing. When I need it stored securely, away from prying eyes, I use Goldcorp. They're the ones I trust. They ship it right to your door, really quick if you want to hold it in your hands, but also if you prefer, they can stash it in top-tier vaults in places like Switzerland or Singapore or right here in the United States. Your call, your metal. And for you, my friends who follow Peak Prosperity, they'll hook you up with the first 6 months of storage absolutely free. That's how much they value real people like us. Buying and selling? Hey, it's as easy as trading stocks, but way better. Because with Goldcorp, you're the sole owner. Fully allocated, fully segregated, in your name only. No sharing with strangers, no funny business, no security entitlement nonsense. Need cash fast? Sell in seconds at market price? Want it in your hands? Hey, one click and it's shipped. They've got everything from coins and bars to allowing for self-directed IRAs, all locked down and secure. It's simple, it's safe, and straightforward. Take charge of your future, folks. Don't wait for the system to fail you any further. Head over to peak.fan/goldcore. That's peak.fan/goldcore right now and claim that free storage. You won't regret it. I sure don't. Gold and silver are two words to me. They're not the same. Like often they come not even hyphenated, crammed together, gold and silver. Silver's an industrial metal. The thing that caught me is I've been watching this for years, but it looks like 2025 is going to be the first year that 100% of mine output goes towards industrial demand.
Wow.
What happens next year if that goes to 104, 105%, right? It has to come out of investment. And that's just, sorry, that's about as big a supply-demand mismatch as you could hope for.
That's, and you know, to your point, like if it doesn't go to 104, everything on the AI side, the solar side, all of that can't happen. The industrialization of the world, you have, the only way it doesn't go to 104 is if you have another COVID. You probably know the numbers better than me, but like where literally you're shutting down a third of the planet, or else it's going to 104, and then it's going to 108, and then it's going.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, kudos to the silver people. I've been saying I think the gold to silver ratio, I was saying, you know, it would go secularly higher. It did. I stayed with that too long. The, you know, the silver people have been right. And not to say I don't like silver. I do like silver. I think it's, you know, I'm probably being too hard on myself. I own silver. I don't own it big enough. But yeah, you look at that dynamic. And again, especially, I always try to look at the other side of something, right? To be able to argue both sides, right? It's like, okay, well, your math says, all right, it's going to be 100, industrial demand is going to be 104%. Of mine supply. Well, we know how long it takes mines to come up, right? So mines aren't coming up. I don't know if there's anything coming up or not in any time soon, but I know multiple different sources. If you wanted more mine supply and you started today, you're probably looking at 10 years. Jeff, just broadly, that's not silver specific. That's just mining something is what I've been told. And so, okay, well, if the supply's not coming from there. And then the other side of it is okay, well, how do we reduce demand? Again, you have to crush global industrial output. That's not going to happen. I mean, it could. But that's the only other way out of it. Otherwise, it's price. So you either have another COVID to shut down the economy, or it's price. That's it.
Yep. And again, it's that latency, that lag between, oh, we should get more. And by the way, 70% comes from base metal mining, most of that from copper and porphyry mines. So copper mines take a decade or two to open up, because like you said, you have to put the roads in. Oh, we're going to need water, power, you know, all kinds of stuff. You don't just decide that's what you're going to do. I'd like to finish up by asking your, I can't wait to get your views on this, which was, Professor Plum, Michael Green, puts out this view of poverty line at 140K for a family, creates a little bit of a brouhaha, you know, people thinking about it, but how do we define poverty? But back to your earlier point, the stock market tells us right now everything's fine, but those anecdotes and also some of the base data, right? Small business bankruptcies have just hit a record. The non-farms payroll, extremely weak, right? Conference board reading is like some of the worst on record, right? So the consumers are not feeling good. On and on. When we add all this up, is this, I hate to even call it a K-shaped economy because it sounds like there's an even stick going up and down. It's like the top X percent, let's call it 10, are doing very well, but it feels like the bottom 90 are doing very poorly. And we could look at insurance rates, property taxes, actual inflation, da-da-da. What's your view on have we decoupled? Does the consumer no longer matter? Have we gotten that financialized, or what's happening here?
No, it's problematic, and I agree. We're in this sort of K-shaped economy. I have, a good friend of mine owns a higher end landscaping business. We were at dinner about a month and a half ago. He goes, here in the greater Cleveland area, you're either rich or you're poor. That's it. Like, there's no in between. And I think we're getting to, it's another one of these, when you start down a road towards a destination, don't be surprised when you arrive there. And sort of the MMT crowd, the, just paper over, extend and pretend, financialized dynamics we've seen, particularly since the GFC, but really since at least 87, with the 87 crash and 94, 98, 01, 08. The challenge is that when you spend 40 years hollowing out your middle and working class as economic policy, and then that economic policy fails, which is what happened in 08, and instead of marking that to market properly, which would have basically moved away from the sort of the neoliberal Keynesian policies and sort of free, basically economic policy in the United States starting shortly after Volcker became de facto subjugate the U.S. middle and working class in order to support the treasury market, the dollar, Washington deficits, and Wall Street. And that worked fine, and that model blew up in 08. And it should have blown up, and it should have. But instead of marking that to market and starting to do a lot of the things we're hearing now, reshoring and investing and grid and all these things, we papered over it. We extended and pretended. And the problem with that decision, that's fine, and it could work. The release valves were going to be the physical world, and the release valve was going to be political stability in the United States, because basically you were running towards a sort of, as my friend the Cuppy says, he calls it a feudalistic outcome, increasingly feudalistic outcome. And so here we are. We've got an increasingly feudalistic outcome. You've got the worst political stability issues in America in at least 60 years. Peter Turchin asserts that, some of the political violence is reaching levels last seen in the 1850s. And you've got physical world problems. And that's what is so disconcerting. I think, we were talking before we jumped on the air, a lot of graybeards, I think, are increasingly concerned about what they're watching. Investing graybeards are concerned about what they're watching. And I think part of that reason is, part of the reason is these aren't printable problems. If you've got a K-shaped feudalistic economy, printing's going to make it worse. You can't paper over this anymore. You need to invest it, create real supplies, real standard of living growth. And that's, on the other hand, because you've run up debt so much, that's inflationary in the short run. And so you are now coming to the bond market or the currency, the ultimate question, because you start investing to improve real living standards, putting in grid, putting in factories, all these things, they're very inflationary. And with 120% debt to GDP, really inflationary is not in the menu. You either yield curve control and blow up your currency, or the bond market is going to restrict your ability to invest. And from that fundamental standpoint, and then the political stability I touch on political stability, that also touches on the real world. And it recycles back to political stability, because if you want to be able to invest, to have the bond market not stop you, you have to cap bond yields. But if you cap bond yields, inflation is going to get a lot worse, and because they're printing money to get to basically keep a ceiling on bond yields, and that's going to make the inflation worse. And if the inflation gets worse, then the political stability is going to get worse, the upward pressure on the bond market. So you're very quickly getting to this moment that is not fixable in the way that has been problems have been fixed for 40 years in this country, which is extend and pretend and send the factories to a lower cost country to, you know, reduce the inflation, and then, you know, give the hoi polloi, you know, cheap loans when they lose their jobs. That we're at the end of the road there. That's it. You can have real austerity, or you can have, you know, in nominal austerity, or you can have real austerity, which is high inflation and as you rebuild. But that's where we are. And so, yeah, I thought Mike Green's piece was excellent. I thought, you know, I jumped into that fray for a second with a couple of the think tankers in Washington. And to me, I'm a simple guy. I like to try to boil things down. And to me, you know, I put this on my feed over the weekend. In 1964, federal minimum wage was $1.25. That's 5 silver quarters. The quarterback then was 90% silver, if I'm not mistaken. And today, the value of 5 silver quarters, today, 1 silver quarter is worth that $58, $10.60. And so 5 silver quarters that were $1.25 minimum wage in 1964 are today $53. And the gap between $53 today and $1.25 in 1964, when you see those charts showing, you know, the top 1% has done this after 1971, and workers, all of the efficiency and productivity gains we have seen have largely accrued to the top 1%, top 5% since 71, and certainly since 80. The gap between $53 of 5 quarters, what they're worth today, versus $1.25, that's what that's measuring. And so to me, you know, is 140,000 number of what Mike was measuring is in his initial piece. Is that the right number? I don't know. Is it 120? Maybe. Is it 30 like these think tankers are thinking? Like, you could only live in Washington and think that. Like, oh my God. Like, come on. Maybe. Is it 80? Like, is Mike wrong if it's only 80 or 90? No, he's not wrong. So, I thought it was very well done. I think it identifies a critical issue. And to me, as an investor, for me, it's always about, okay, so how do we make money? How do we make money with this? How do we make money with this for our clients? How do we help our clients? How do we help our clients understand what's happening? And for me, I've increasingly, and again, and it ties back to what we're seeing JGBs, ties back to interest rates, ties back Bitcoin, all these. We're now at this point, we've let it go too long. There are no happy answers. We are very quickly getting to that fork in the road. Kill the currency, kill the bond market. Like, that's it. And kill the bond market is let rates spike and bonds plummet and the economy collapses. And that's not really an option in a debt-backed system, because as the bonds fall, they back the currency. And at some point, it goes from being deflationary to hyperinflationary, as people don't understand that very much. Or you have to kill the currency. You've got to, you know, and I use kill the currency. You've got to do some sort of yield curve control. And people say, well, the Japanese did it. Well, the Japanese are net international investment position positive. They run a surplus. They're domestic. They're in deflation. There's a whole boundary. When we do it, and I think it is a when, some form of yield curve control, it's not going to feel like Japan with deflation. It's going to feel like Argentina. And I would argue we're already in the early stages. When you see S&P priced in gold doing what it's doing, which is declining, that's the early stages of U.S. with Argentina outcomes. So anyway, that's a long-winded answer. I apologize for rambling on, but it's such an important issue. And it's so interesting to me that when Mike raised it the way he did, the response he got. This wasn't, hey, let me think about this, or maybe something to think about what Mike said. This was, what was it? It was like the single dumbest, like wealth study I've ever seen or something like that. It was like, ooh, somebody's getting flack because he's over the target.
Yeah, that's such a great answer. And, you know, it reminds me, I put this in the original Crash Course in 08, you know, so long ago now, but the quote from Plutarch, who said, "The oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics is a gap between the rich and the poor." And it just happens when the rich get so disconnected and they get in their little bubble thing and the world just works, you know, and ultimately revolutions start at the bottom with the young. And so when I talk to young people, I get out of that think tank world, and I actually, Luke, I talk to young people, they're pissed. A lot of them realize that not only have they sort of been rugged at the beginning of their life, but they have no reasonable path to participating in it unless your parents were wealthy, right? Like, for a lot of them, there's no realistic path. And so that this is the dumbest study ever is, I feel like it's boomers and Xers pulling up the moat and saying, we got ours, you know, good luck, you know, eat cake. It feels like I'm not sure they're really reading the room on this one.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, I'm here in Rust Belt, Ohio, right? So, you know, I was at a conference 4 years ago. Actually, it was at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, right? It was a new, you know, we were talking about monetary issues as it was at the same hotel. And, you know, I said something on stage, which elicited some smirks and some discomfort. But I said, listen, consensus in the West, now this is summer of 21, consensus in the West, the Chinese cannot win the great power competition. I'm from Cleveland. I've lived in the Rust Belt my whole life. Let me assure you, they can absolutely win because I've seen it happen for the last 20 years. And in the last 4 years, there's been this recognition amongst sort of the Beltway class of like, oh, China has a competitor. They can compete. The tech guys are going, oh my gosh, like we actually have to, we have foreigners competing with us in tech for the first time in our entire lives. What do we do? Help Washington, defend us, put up barriers, right? Like just like the automakers did, by the way, right? Mm-hmm. Didn't work for them, right? You know.
Yeah.
So I you know, I have three boys. They are 24, you know, 23, 21, or no, 24, 22, and 19. And my wife and I have been very blessed. And so we have been able to give them some options that aren't available to a lot. And we also have very honest conversations, and I see with their friends and et cetera, there is absolutely a feeling, you know, and Peter Thiel wrote about it like very presciently, like 15 years ago, about the coming generational gap in war. And yeah, I think there is absolutely that feeling. And I think one of the sparks that really lit it was the way COVID was dealt with, which was, you know, you boys, you can't do any of your activities. You need to sit at home for something that has de minimis impact to you, you know, so that you can keep the boomers safe. And I'm not saying the boomers shouldn't have been safe. All I'm saying is I don't think the policymakers have understood the latent frustration that layered onto a situation around already sort of this unclear path to, you know, what the boomers had when they were 22. And yes, I know you guys all paid 10, 15% mortgages. And like, it was literally a meme, you know, Senator Blutarsky had a 0.0 GPA and ended up being a senator. And that's, you know, hyperbolic, but sort of like literally as a boomer, you know, you could sort of fall out of a truck, you know, get arrested a few times and like, boom, you're like within 5 years, you're great. You paid a high mortgage, but you were making good money. It was a different world. These kids, they don't have that. And there's a level of frustration. There's a level of frustration there. And increasingly too, and this has nothing to do with the boomers, but this AI thing, they're seeing it firsthand, and it is, you know, it's hard to get hired. It is much harder to get hired. I'm hearing this over and over. You know, friends of ours that are, you know, graduated Yale economics honors, multilingual, amazingly talented, couldn't find a job. Like, come on. And so they went back to grad school, and that's fine. But there's this AI layered on top of it, I think, is going to be another forcing function, because it's going to start with the kids, right? Like this, the AI has a harder time replicating what I might do or what you might do, or somebody who's in the 50s and 60s. It has a very easy time, you know, unemploying or just leading to the non-hiring of a 22-year-old. And I tell my boys this all the time, like, listen, you guys don't know anything. Like, just be a sponge. Yes, sir. Do what you got to do. Compete. But like, you know, my wife and I, we've already been preparing them for that world. But I get the sense that we're probably not, you know, We're not in the majority of parents kind of, listen, have you thought about this as a career? Have you thought about this? Or if this happens, then you're going to do this, or you should do one of these. We have very open conversations about that that need to be happening. They're not happening. It's only going to add to the frustration.
Well, it is. And so, you know, we outsourced our manufacturing jobs and basically told the affected people, pound sand, learn to code, or whatever the dismissive things were. And then now AI is about to gobble up some significant fraction of our so-called service economy jobs, right? CPAs, lawyers, you know, hospital administrators. I think AI does a great job. I would really look forward. In fact, one of the areas that's going to really hopefully get pounded is government factotums, right? You work at the DMV, you work at the DHS or someplace, AI can take your job over and do it way better, right? So, you know, with 1 in 6 people working for government on some level, I think we could trim that back a little. And maybe that's a positive in this story. But again, there's like no larger cultural conversation, which is like sitting your kids down and going, wow, A, I don't even know what you're going through because it's not what I went through and I have no experience with it. It looks kind of weird. But to your point, the trauma of COVID, one of the last universities to drop their COVID shot mandate was Harvard. And there was no rational basis for it, right? It didn't stop transmission. It didn't help the people who were actually taking the shots. All it did was make the boomer, you know, professors feel a little safer in the classroom or something like that. Think of the Trump. Like, there's certain things. Like, if your dad, this didn't happen to me, but I could imagine, if your dad looks you in the eye and says, I've never loved you and I hate you, like, that's going to have a lasting impact, right? It's going to take a little while to, maybe you never actually repair that fracture. COVID fractured something in the social contract. It said, 100%. You have to sacrifice for us, and we're going to leave you not even breadcrumbs to follow in your own path, you know?
Yeah, and it's one of these things where I think ultimately the devil will take the hindmost. In other words, mm-hmm. who owns all the bonds that are going to get repressed? It's the boomers, right? Ultimately, like, they can pay for their healthcare with more taxes, or they can pay for their, you know, their entitlements with more taxes, or if they don't, and they're not, they'll pay for what they use via inflation, and they will, their bonds, you know, will, you know, they'll go from eating steak to eating hamburger to eating dog food in their retirement. And that's, it's not what I'm hoping for. I'm just looking at the math and the, you know, the double entry bookkeeping of it. It's like, okay, those are your choices. And yes, they paid into it, but the nominal expenses of sort of what they paid in versus some assumption of return relative to what they're taking out. No, by the way, all that money was spent as it went in. Let's be honest. And that wasn't necessarily their fault, right? They didn't, you know, they got screwed over by Vietnam, you know, and sort of the economic outcome of that, the real life cost of that. But so this is like a long, this is not just a boomer story. This is, you know, arguably it's, you know, 50, 60, 70 years of just chronic short-termism. And at some point, you just run out of road and you've got to choose the bond market or the currency.
Given that, I'm really out of ideas. As I mentioned before we began this, the three legs of my investing stool are gold and silver, are financial assets, because I have every confidence that when we get to that fork in the road, the Fed's going to print. But maybe I have that wrong, but I pretty sure about that, but that's my view. And then my farm. Just ultimately, one of these three is going to hit, you know, and I really hope it's not the farm, but it could, because this is pretty legendary mismanagement we're up against right now. And, you know, if we get to the point, Luke, I think where we get to the crisis stage, we're like, oh, okay, let's get serious about putting in more energy infrastructure. And then you grow up and you suddenly discover that there's a 5-year wait for generators or 2-year wait for transformers, and you can't. It just gets hard to try and repair things in the midst of a crisis, you know? It's harder.
Yeah, it's like trying to fix an airplane, right, while you're flying. It's,
yeah. How do you do that?
And that's the challenge. And you can think about the debt as sort of your velocity, right? Like the more the debt there is, the faster you're moving, right? And, you know, mm-hmm. if you want to think it's, you know, less complicated, fixing a car. Well, it's hard while it's moving, but you could do it conceivably at 5 miles an hour, 10 miles an hour. At 90, 100, it starts to become physically impossible, because every time you reach outside, to the, you know, like you get blown away. So, and the velocity is the debt, right? So to me... there's two big elephants in the room. it is the physical infrastructure and the physical constraints that we're talking about, right? Of, hey, it's 5 years for a generator and what have you. And especially relative to the calls or the demand on that current and prospective generation. And then there's the debt, which is anytime you act too quickly here that it generates inflation is going to want to rise in yield and create financial market problems that then completely undermine your ability to invest to fix the first problem. And then there might even be the third, which is AI is now moving so fast on borrowed money. What you're really doing is borrowing money, competing with the borrowing of to try to invest in the grid, to invest in something that is undermining your tax base at an accelerating rate, because half of, you know, employment is half of the tax base. So you're, it's like this multiple headed snake eating its own tail. I don't know how they, it sets up for a very difficult best case. Like, we're now into the point where people are like, well, it's going to be fine. Like, maybe, but it's going to be fine is, in my opinion, now a tail outcome. And maybe a fat tail outcome. So that then now you're into, okay, how ugly can it get? And it can get really ugly. That's not my base case, but like, I think the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years, like, we're going to get our money's worth in the fourth turning. Like, we're going to, in sort of the climax and denouement of this whole fourth turning, I think we're going to get our money's worth. And, you know, to your point, you know, I wasn't there, of course, but in the Great Depression, one of the things that FDR did so well was he was a great communicator. He sat down and was just honest with people. And, you know, they did commissions, you know, the Pecora Commission, right, to look into who went after, you know, to the, you know, what the improprieties that were done by Wall Street that led to the losses. And right. So there was some, he did some accountability. He did some communications. He did a bunch of stuff where he was just throwing crap against the wall and hope it stuck, right, in terms of trying to figure out. And I just don't see, not even just the leader to communicate that, but I don't even see if we had that leader, if they would be able to do it. Like, I think Vance actually could communicate in that way, but he can't in his current role because he's the vice president, not the president. Just based on, and this is not saying right or left, but just his ability to communicate concepts like how the dollar has driven wealth inequality and is in a questioning Powell and discussing in very plain language with the Europeans earlier this year of like, listen, guys, like, what are we doing here? He could possibly, but we don't have that communicator. We don't have the ability, if we have that communicator, to sit down and say, if it was me, I'd sit down and say, listen, America, I'm not going to run again because after I'm done saying what I'm saying here, none of you are going to elect me. Here's the truth. Your leaders have been lying to you for 60 years. We have been living a debt-fueled party ever since 71, and we've made mistakes. The offshoring was a mistake. The bailing outs were a mistake. The wars were a mistake. And when you make a mistake, you have to take your medicine. And when here's what taking the medicine looks like. It's going to be inflationary. It's going to be, you know, real living standards are going to fall. Inflation is going to be high. We're going to need to work together and stop fighting with each other and allowing ourselves to be divided. We've got to stop going to prospective wars. We don't get to tell the Chinese and the Russians what to do. We can't even, you know, we can't even put a grid together. Like we need to retrench. And so that's a very difficult conversation into an America that has, to be blunt, not been in enough pain in their lifetimes to understand that conversation, right? You've got the boomers who are just, you know, the children who never want to grow up. You know, I mean, I see protests, people, you know, grannies holding signs like, you know, no kings. I'm like, you guys are the kings. You're the kings.
and I see kings.
Kids who are like, oh, I've worked 3 days. This is so hard. I have to work 40 hours for the next 30 years, like, they're not, you know, is this what happens when you give them all trophies? And us in Gen X are kind of like, you know, we're like free range chickens for our, we're like, what is going on here with you people? Like, come on. So I'm not that optimistic that, you know, there has to be some sort of catalyst around, okay, Because that's a conversation, whether it happens or just whether the conversation happens or whether we just set about doing that, something has to catalyze that. And that catalyst has to be fairly dramatic and eye-opening. And the odds of that being something really pleasant is, in my opinion, slim and none. And I don't know what that is, but like, that's where we are. It's, being a Gen Xer, looking up at the boomers, looking down at millennials and Gen Z, you're just like, okay.
Well, that's so well said, and really brilliant. And I agree with all of it. It was 2018, Bridgewater Associates put out an IOU plus debt to GDP chart, and it was 1,200%. It's probably worse. And I looked at that chart, and I realized there's only one question that has to be nationally addressed and advertised, hopefully with a great communicator, which is somebody. It's like that last scene in National Treasure. Harvey Keitel says, somebody's got to go to jail, Ben. You know. So what we're at is like the only question to answer is, who's going to eat the losses? Right? That's it. And of course, the K Street, you know, banker, they don't want it to be them. But if that turns into everybody else, you don't just get a Mamdani in New York. You get a Mamdani as president, right? You get something very redistributive, is a sort of a euphemism I might use, that's going to be exceedingly unpleasant. And I don't want to go there. I'd rather not. I'd rather that we have the rip the Band-Aid off conversation. So thank you for saying that.
No, I appreciate it. And I agree. People, you know, when I think it was right around this time last year, tragically, right? When Brian Thompson, UnitedHealthcare mm-hmm. president or CEO, gets shot in the streets of Manhattan. Like, what? Obviously, the Charlie Kirk situation, the Mamdani, these are not these are no longer isolated incidences. These, there is a rising political anger here, and I understand why. Mm-hmm. And without that great communicator, without that kind of reset of, the loss has to fall on somebody's head. And it either falls in real terms or it falls in nominal terms. You can look where the spending is happening is very, very obvious if you want to try austerity, but that's, a political non-starter. And if you inflate, that's also an issue. And that's why we're really to this. We're not quite to the fork in the road, but like the fork in the road is pretty, it's not that far from here.
Mm. So, how do you help people navigate this then? So let's imagine that there are people with 401ks, portfolios, investment decisions to be made. Like how do you begin parsing something this tricky?
I think you start by having the humility to recognize exactly how big it is, how generational it is. Try to avoid, hey, it's that group's fault or this group's fault. It's nobody's fault and it's everybody's fault. This is, we are living it is our fate to live through this part of the long cycle that has been repeated over and over. And then to have the humility around, like, I've got a portfolio, and to your point of a third, a third, a third, right? Like, I'm going to lose some soldiers here, right? I'm going to, and what I've advised, people that have asked me that question, knowing what I think I know and the sort of potential paths, for me, I advise breaking down a portfolio, into, what a guy named Jacob Fugger did, F-U-G-G-E-R, was one of the wealthiest men as a percent of economic output in all of history. I think he was a Dutch merchant. I should know. It's probably 1400s or 1500s, 1600s. At any rate, he advised quarter of your money in gold, quarter of your money in land, quarter of your money, he said, in government bonds. But I think the right way to think about that are high dividend paying or blue chip equities, and then a quarter of your money in cash, and then just rebalance. Because now we're in an environment where, if we look at it on a normal distribution curve, the tails are very fat at both ends. And so there's a very fat tail risk of some sort of very deflationary austerity. In that world, cash is going to do well. gold is going to do well because there's huge, huge default risk and gold has no counterparty risk. Your stocks are going to get killed and your land is probably, if it's productive land, you're going to still have a yield, but the land prices are probably going to fall broadly in that world. That's your right tail. But you survive. You survive that. Your wealth, because your gold's going to go up a ton, your cash is fine, gives you some optionality. You survive. The other side is, again, I don't think this is going to happen. Some sort of brief period of hyperinflation where your cash goes to zero. Your stocks probably keep up with it. Your land actually probably falls in value to cash value because at some point in hyperinflation, mortgages stop being made and all land starts transacting in cash because banks will take a while, but they don't make 30-year mortgages or 5-year mortgages, much less 30-year mortgages in hyperinflation. They're not dumb. And your gold does great. But here, too, you survive. And everything in between, if you can survive those two, if you have a portfolio that survives and does fine through those two extremes, then your last one that is you have to figure out how to manage is your sort of, your political risk, your domestic political risk. And that's based on, your locality of where you live, your nation of where you live, the risks of war, these sort of extremes. But if you think of this is, if I was just the average person right now, the average investor, if I was the average RIA, I'd be thinking about this. If I was the average billionaire, I would be thinking like this. And that's what, I don't say it lightly. And by the way, this is a model for what Ray Dalio has run his all-weather portfolio on, some version of this Jacob Fugger portfolio. So for me, it's really about having the humility to understand, we really haven't seen this in a very long time. None of us alive have lived this. And I would argue that maybe no human alive has ever lived it at this scale. We've had breakdowns in globalism in 1910, 12, 14 through 45, and that was probably the biggest instance there. None of us were around then. And this is bigger, the derivatives are bigger, the debt's bigger, the globalism, everything's faster, right? Because we're all connected, we don't have to wait for letters, etc. So that's how I would answer the question, is just that, take away the tails, where you are, make your portfolio impossible to kill at the two big tail risks, and then, rebalance as you need to.
Brilliant. That's absolutely well said. So, thank you for your time today. And, you're very generous with your time and your insight. So I want to thank you for that. And, I know that people can find you on Twitter at Luke Roman. And also they can find you at FTT.com. Is that correct?
FFTT. Yeah. FFTT-LLC.
Sorry.
Yeah. FFTT-LLC.com.
Yep. FFTT-LLC.com. Okay. Thanks. And I do know people who recently subscribed to your newsletter and, at first they were like, can I afford this? And now they're saying best investment they've ever made. So, good feedback from within my circle. So
I appreciate awesome that. It's my life's work. It's a joy. That'll work a day in my life. I'm very blessed.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, thank you. And listen, best of luck going into the new year. And let's do this again at some point.
Likewise to you. And I'd love to. So thank you very much. Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here. And have a very happy holiday. Merry Christmas and happy new year.